So if you have not checked your email in the last half hour or so, you do now have a copy of the handout of the Fisher stereochemistry proof in your possession. And I'm going to try to give you an overview of it today, which we started the other day when we were talking about osazones, these crystalline derivatives of sugars that allowed sugars to be derivatized and characterized. There are five steps, if you want to call it that, to the proof. The first is the assumption of the D configuration. The second is the realization that glucose and mannose are epimers that can be synthesized from D-arabinose. That arabinaric acid is optically active. That glucuric and mannuric acids are also optically active. And that D-glucose and L-gulose both form the same aldaric acid. So, point one of the proof we've already established, that in glyceraldehyde, Fisher made a monumentally lucky guess.
What are these five things called?
These are the five steps that are going to get us the configurations of the four stereocenters of glucose through observation of optical activity as the sole way of physically characterizing the compounds. You just wanted to what? A title. This is the Fisher glucose stereochemistry proof. So Fisher guessed that the configuration of, let me make sure I've got the sign correct since I have my own handout to look at. So Fisher guessed that the configuration of D-glyceraldehyde I'll just erase to that. Fisher guessed the configuration of D-glyceraldehyde. Period, end of story. From that, we get this. That out of all the configurations that are possible for glucose, we eliminate half of them because we're going to assume that that last stereocenter is the same as the stereocenter in glyceraldehyde because we learned the Kiliani-Fisher chain extension reaction on Monday, and you could use that three times in a row to, let's see, one, two, three. Yes, add three more carbons to glyceraldehyde in order to be able to synthesize glucose. There's also this thing called a Wohl degradation that we'll cover at some point where you could take a larger sugar, chop it apart, and end up with a smaller sugar. And so there's two directions by building up and breaking down to demonstrate the relationships between the different sizes of sugars. So I guess step zero is that Fisher knew that it was glucose, that is, an aldohexose. So in fact, let me go back and write that at the top. Glucose is an aldohexose. So once you know that, you know there's four stereocenters. He assumed one of the stereocenters, and so the rest of these steps of the proof are to figure out the configurations of those remaining centers. Now, does anybody have any question on this first step? Okay. The next observation is that glucose and mannose are ethanoers that can be synthesized from arabinose. So remember arabinose's structure. From top to bottom, the OH groups are left, right, right. We have a threefold sequence of reacting with hydrogen cyanide, which forms nitrile, which we then selectively reduce, so palladium and hydrogen, with a poison catalyst to control and make just the imine. Then those imines are hydrolyzed, which gives us our two new sugars. As we already covered on Monday, there's a new stereocenter created, and since that stereocenter, regardless of the actual percentage of each compound is formed, since there's two configurations possible, we make two different products. One of which we know is glucose, one of which we know is mannose, but at that time, they didn't know which was which. They just knew that the both could come from arabinose. And again, this is important because there's only three stereocenters in arabinose. Those three stereocenters are the same bottom three stereocenters that are in glucose and mannose. And so if you can figure out anything about the configuration of arabinose, you automatically know what one of the configurations in glucose and mannose is. And I'll write that down. Since glucose and mannose can be synthesized from arabinose, if the configuration of a stereocenter of arabinose is established, then its stereocenter in glucose and mannose is established as well. Now, from our perspective many years later, we could look back and say, well, this is good enough. Remember that I did discuss that besides the fact that osazones were useful at that time because they allowed for the formation of crystalline products, they also showed in another way that glucose and mannose were epimers of each other, because you lose one stereocenter when you take either of those sugars, the top stereocenter, you lose when you're making the osazones. Since, again, the bottom three stereocenters are identical, then that means that you get the same osazone product from either sugar. Taylor?
Could you indicate
that it would be synthesized
from arabinose?
Did I what? I'm
sorry? Since glucose and
thank one of your classmates for this, classmate who felt pity that I had to keep stealing everybody else's. Quite fortuitous. Oh, look at that. It never happened. Ooh. No, I just remember my reading of 1984 back in high school, and there's our information change right there. How many of you have read the book 1984 just out of curiosity? No, that's actually kind of frightening. I could go off for hours on that one. Wow. All I can say is that anybody living in this world where all we have to do is flip a switch and we can look at any camera across the world, you might want to read that book sometime. Back to the story. Any questions about the second step? All right. Then we were starting to get into the third step a little bit at the end of lecture the other day, which is the idea that arabinic acid is optically active. So as section one has seen, section two will see, there is a set of reagents, aqueous bromine, or not aqueous bromine, sorry, we're making the aldaric acid. So it's nitric acid that can be used to oxidize the primary alcohol at the bottom of the molecule and the aldehyde at the top. Section two, most OCHEM textbooks don't explain the reactivity of this reagent. They don't show the mechanism for it. I'm going to go off and find it to see if it would be useful for our discussions. If I don't find it in time, then all you need to know is what happens, not why. The what happens is this is an aldaric acid. Specifically, this is D-arabinic acid. Now, let's say we didn't know what the stereocenters were, though. I'm showing you the end result. And there is this statement that it's optically active. But let's see what that means. Because what Fisher knew going into it was this. That arabinic acid, he had assumed the configuration of one stereocenter and was trying to guess the configuration of the other two. But I'll say it again. Arabinic acid is optically active. And here's why this proof is kind of an elegant piece of work. Because out of these two stereocenters, just by knowing that the compound is optically active, we automatically know the configuration of one. Which one is it and why? So look at that compound, and I'm telling you it's optically active. Automatically, you know the configuration of one of those two other stereocenters. Why? Because what? No, it's optically active, so its mirror image is not the same as itself. I didn't say meso. It's not meso. Because actually, that's the only way that this would be optically inactive. In fact, that's the way you could get at this. How do we make this optically inactive? Make the top stereocenter on the right. The only way this compound be optically inactive. Oh, thank you. The only way it's optically inactive is if it is meso. which would require an internal mirror plane, which means the OH group would have to be on the right. Now, a little bit of an aside here. Are these compounds both meso? Are these compounds both meso? Yes, they are. Because there's a mirror plane in both. They're both meso because of the configuration of the top stereocenter. How many stereocenters are in this molecule? Now, what's our fallback definition of what a stereocenter is? For tetrahedral carbon, it's if you have four different substituents attached. Do we have four different substituents attached to the central carbon? No, we don't. So I'll ask the question again. How many stereocenters are in this compound? But are these the same compound? Then what about the middle carbon? Isn't it a stereocenter? But if it was, these couldn't be meso, could they? So what is it? This is called a pseudo-stereocenter, which is created when you do have similar substituents that have different configurations. Here's another way of putting it. A pseudo-stereocenter is a carbon that produces stereoisomers but cannot be formally assigned a configuration of RS. Since two of the carbon substituents are equivalent. For a pseudo-stereocenter, instead of capital R and capital S, we have the configurations little r and little s. How do we determine that? Well, the top stereocenter of the first of these compounds, is it R or S? Top stereocenter of this first compound, is it R or S? Okay, I heard both answers. You have a 50-50 chance. Alcohol is priority number one. Carbon with three oxygens, and notice that is the equivalent of having three oxygens on it. So carbon with three oxygens versus a carbon with only one oxygen. This is the second importance. This is the third. This is the fourth. It looks like it is S, because the hydrogen is pointed towards you. It's really R. Since the bottom half of the molecule is the mirror image of itself, the bottom stereo center is S. Now, both of those arms are less important when we now look from the viewpoint of the middle stereo center. Both of these arms are less important than the oxygen group. So from that middle stereo center, we know the top is R, because in height, we know the bottom is S. We know that automatically the priority of the oxygen is number one. In stereo configurations, R is given higher priority than S, which on the basis of that tiebreaker, that makes the top group now priority two, the bottom group priority three. It's counterclockwise, but the hydrogen is pointed towards us, which means it's not being viewed correctly, so it'd be the equivalent of R, but it's little r, because it's not really a stereo center, but it is, but it isn't, but it is. That's why it's a pseudo stereo center. That means that the configuration of the middle stereo center up here is little s. So to determine the pseudo configuration of a pseudo stereo center, R is given priority over S. That's more of a side story, because this is our first example that I bothered to talk about, the fact that this situation occurs, that you can have meso compounds that have internal planes of symmetry, but odd number of carbons. But what's the point of all of this? That it didn't matter what the configuration of the middle stereo center was, because in both cases, it gives you a meso compound. The observation that Fisher made is that this compound is supposed to be optically active. Arabidopsis acid is optically active. That means it can't be either of these two compounds. So that means whatever compound it is, the top stereo center is on the left. So that leaves two possibilities for what arabidopsis is. We don't know the middle stereo center then, but we know the top one. No, this is not Kentucky Fried Chicken entree. This is Chiliotti Fisher chain extension. Which means we've figured out a second stereo center of glucose. So first step of the, we don't know that yet. Oh, I'm gonna love this toy. Well, one more stereo center down, two more to go. Now, does anybody have any questions on this step? Yeah, you do. You just don't know to ask it yet. So I'll cover it again really quickly. We make this connection chemically between arabidopsis and glucose and mannose so that we know that if we establish a stereo center in arabidopsis, the same one can be established in glucose and mannose. We know that arabinose makes an acid upon oxidation that has the same functional group at the top and bottom, which means just on the basis of the number of stereocenters alone, it is technically possible to have meso compounds. But Fischer observed that this acid is optically active. The only way that it could be optically active is if the top and bottom stereocenters are configured oppositely from each other, not in terms of RNS, but in terms of direction. Because if they were the same, then regardless of the middle stereocenter, it's going to be meso. Since it's not meso, because it is optically active, that means the top stereocenter has to be opposite from the bottom, which is how we get one of the configurations in glucose. The next step is exactly the same type of logic. What are we on? Step four? And this is that glucuric and I'm going to put heavy emphasis on that word and, glucuric and mineric acids are optically active. What does that mean? That means we take glucose and oxidize it, and we again end up with the same stereocenter at the top or the bottom. Well, with just the two stereocenters we have so far determined, that means there are four possible molecules left. And here are the aldaric acids of them. Yes, there are the four possibilities. Are any of them meso? Which one is meso? The second one, okay? Which means it cannot be synthesized. Or cannot be the aldaric acid of glucose and mannose. What is the only difference between glucose and mannose? So the top stereocenter doesn't matter. That means that the third stereocenter cannot be on the left. And that's the fourth step of the proof. I know, I just kind of hit you with it. Like, that's it? Yes, that's it. Yeah. Psh, that kind of thing. Look at it again. There's four possible compounds. Only one of them is meso. The one that's meso can't be glucose, and it can't be mannose. Which means it doesn't matter what the configuration of the top stereocenter is. If on either side, having that top stereocenter on either side, if either one of the cases makes the molecule meso, both of them are wrong. In other words, the third stereocenter's configuration is also wrong. As you can see, once we eliminate those two choices, we're left with what we now know to be glucose and mannose. There's a whole string of ways that I could express this one step. I'm going to attempt one way to do it, and I might end up saying the other ways the few times when we review this. In case you all are worried, you don't have to worry, because yes, it's on the exam and the final, because why would I have been talking about this proof for so long if I didn't expect you to know it? And know it not to the level of detail that's in that handout, because I use all kinds of words and names and things that you'll never see again that are in that handout. But what I've got here in lecture, every little juicy detail of it, yeah, I want you to know. But it is only five steps, if you can get your heads around those five steps. Yes? Why wouldn't it be? Because we've been working on this for weeks. The question was, would it be on next Friday's exam? If you've already been working on carbohydrates, this is plenty of time to work it, to learn it. If, as I can gauge from section one, you haven't looked at the carbohydrate chapter at all, because people weren't even able to quickly distinguish between the names and which one's glucose and mannose and aldose and ketose and this-ose and that-ose and whatever-ose, then it might mean that this Fisher proof is going to be a little more painful to learn, because on top of learning all this logic, you've got to go back and learn your allose, aldose, glucose, mannose, glucose, aldose, galactose, tallose, and all your other sugars and DNL and this and that and alpha and beta and drawing the rings and Hayworth projections, aldetols and aldaric acids, aldonic acids, and what do we do today? Sucrose and lactose and oh dear, os. So. But yes, every little bit of the carbohydrate chemistry that we've been learning so far will be on the exam, with the only stipulation that the exam's only going to last one period. So that means whatever doesn't show up on the exams, on the final. Yes?
Did you cross up the last one just because you knew that it didn't look a thing like mannose?
I'm going to write down why I crossed off the last one, because it's exactly why I did that that's the confusing step of this point of the proof. Okay. Is that your same question? Okay, here's the answer for that. Glucose and mannose have the same configuration for the third stereocenter. I think we can all agree that I'm calling these first, second, third, fourth from top to bottom. Seems a logical way to label these. They're technically carbons 2, 3, 4, 5. They're stereocenters number 1, 2, 3, 4. So the third stereocenter in glucose and mannose are the same. They only differ by the first stereocenter. Therefore, if any structure is demonstrated not to be either glucose or mannose, then any structure that contains that same configuration for the third stereocenter cannot be either glucose or mannose. It's a very simple statement that takes a lot of words to say. It means that I got two choices, that stereocenter on the right or the left. At the same time, I've got two choices for the top stereocenter. That's why I wrote these four compounds down. One of these four compounds I identified as being meso, when it's oxidized to its aldaric acid, because then the top and the bottom are identical. That third stereocenter, if it was glucose or mannose, if this was glucose, then that same stereocenter has to be there in mannose. If this was mannose, that same stereocenter would have to be there in glucose. In either case, if one or the other is meso, they're both wrong, because they have to be related by having that same third stereocenter. So when I cross one of them out, I automatically cross the one that has the same configuration at that third stereocenter out. Did that make any more sense the second time I said it? Then I look what I'm writing and try to write it a different way for the third time. Glucose and mannose have the same configuration for the third stereocenter. They only differ by the first stereocenter. Therefore, if the third stereocenter is shown to be incorrect for either compound, it is incorrect for both. This is why two compounds were eliminated as possibilities, when one of the two was shown to be meso. Upon oxidation. That's the same thing I said a minute ago, but yet again a slightly subtle restatement. So therefore, what does that mean? We only have the top stereocenter left to determine, because step one was to assume the bottom stereocenter. Step two was make a link to arabinose. Step three was to realize that arabinose shows us the second stereocenter has to be configured a certain way, and then this observation about glucose and mannose when you oxidize them establishes the third stereocenter. So only one stereocenter is left unknown. Which brings us to the last and most difficult step of the proof. That glucose makes an aldaric acid that another sugar can too. Now, what in the world does that have to do with anything? And this is probably the coolest and trickiest bit of logic at all. The guy, besides his other chemistry, because he did other stuff than just this proof, all that put together, though, he did get a Nobel Prize for this. Because realize, there's no melting points, IR, anything here. It's all logic based on optical rotation. What would happen if I were to flip the functional groups at the top and the bottom of this molecule? Well, in one case, nothing would happen, in a sense, at least once we oxidized. Or even if we didn't oxidize, let me think about that. We didn't oxidize it, yes. In other words, watch this. Here's mannose. And let's just imagine that something allowed those stereocenters to be inverted. Not the stereocenters, the functional groups. This magic is a series of steps that is in the handout. There are probably steps we won't talk about in lecture. That handout, the level of depth I put in it, was because I got tired of using six different OCHEM books to teach one topic. Because one would talk about this aspect of it. One would talk about that one. One would mention this little detail about that. One would show you this. One showed the mechanism of phenylhydrazine. So I put it all together in one place. It's a little overkill, but I'm at least admitting that. But there is a way shown in that handout that we can chemically flip the two groups around. Imagine we had all 16 aldohexoses. Here's where we're going with this, because if I now take this sugar and turn it 180 degrees, what do I get? They're the same compound, aren't they? In other words, mannose, mannaric acid, which you would get from it, with nitric acid, Tyler, are you here? For you, Tyler, would this be C2V or not? He'll know what I mean. Anybody else taking enough math to ever get into point groups? Oh. Well, then let's look at that molecule and realize that if I turn it 180 degrees around, it's the same as itself. In other words, this is rotationally symmetric. And the significance of that is there is no other molecule that can give the aldohexic acid that comes from mannose, because the only way we could generate some other molecule is to flop the functional groups. But when we flop the functional groups, we get the same molecule back again. So only one out of all 16 sugars can give us this particular aldohexic acid, which means it is mannose. Because the point of the last step of the proof is that some other molecule besides glucose can make the aldohexic acid that glucose does. Why? Because glucose in its acid, its glucuric acid form, is not rotationally symmetric. Now let's see why that matters. So this was mannose I was doing it with. Now let's take D-glucose. Again, we either in real life synthesize it or just imagine it. Because in real life, all the different sugars were made, their derivatives were compared. It was found there were two that made the same one, and one of those two compounds was glucose. That's because if you flip the functional groups, for those of you who can read upside down, what molecule did I just make? For everybody else that's just mere human, if we write it the correct way around, what sugar is this? First of all, is it a D or an L sugar? Which means everything that you memorize for the D, it's backwards. So flip them all around. What is it? It's what? Did you say glucose? Gulose. You're right. 0010, which is 4. Allose, altose, glucose, mannose, gulose. But they both, if you oxidize them, make the same aldohexic acid. And this is the point. Because the difference between glucose and mannose is just the top stereocenter. For mannose, because of its configuration, when you oxidize it, it's rotationally symmetric, which is why there's no other compound that can give you that acid. For glucose, it is not rotationally symmetric if you were to oxidize it. So if somehow you could take from the acid and go back down to either one of these two compounds, the point is you're going to get two possibilities. Because which is the top and which is the bottom gets scrambled when you oxidize it. And that's the last step of the proof. But because two compounds make the same aldaric acid, and only by putting the top configuration on the right gives us this situation, that is its configuration, and so we know that's glucose. Then in 1951, when the DNL question was resolved, it really was shown that that really is glucose, and that's the Fischer stereochemistry proof. So what's the first step of the proof? You act like I'm not serious. What's the first step of the proof? Okay, the zero step, which is that glucose is an aldohexose, which could be determined by successive degradation of a sugar to get it down to glyceraldehyde. And we can do three degradations to get there, which, since glyceraldehyde has three carbons plus three degradations makes six. And there's another test that we can talk about later that shows it's an aldose. So glucose is an aldohexose. If I call that the zero step, then what's really step one of the proof? He guessed the D configuration. What's step two of the proof? That glucose and mannose are epimers and... they come from arabinose, which means we know that three of the stereocenters in arabinose are the same as glucose and mannose. What is the third step? Don't look at your notes. Use your brains. What's the third step? Because why do we care that arabinose is related to glucose and mannose? Because we're going to use arabinose. The third step is that arabinaric acid is optically active. Someone volunteered to explain to me why do we care as far as this proof is concerned. That was a test question across multiple quizzes or tests in Chem 12C, exactly what I just asked. What is the significance of arabinaric acid being optically active? It's not meso, which means what? That there's only one possibility as far as the configuration of the top stereocenter. It must be opposite of the bottom, otherwise you couldn't end up with an optically active aldaric acid. That's the two-sentence answer. Notice it doesn't take five paragraphs to give the answer. Now, if I only gave you 20 minutes to write out your logic and presentation of this proof, how would you do it? I would strongly suggest you figure that out before next Friday. And that's the end of lecture today.